I'm Veronica Dudo in Washington, D.C. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, Back on Track. A Senate panel advances the nomination of acting attorney Todd Blanche, but he still faces a major hurdle before crossing the confirmation finish line. War zone. Not only is the fight against the Spokane wildfires far from over, we are now learning the largest blaze could have been avoided. Fever pitch. A battle between European soccer body UEFA and FIFA president Gianni Infantino may be coming to a head. Plus, why the saint of the day holds such a special place to parish priests. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. John Vianney, our top story tonight. Senior Trump administration officials are optimistic a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz could be reached soon. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent both discussed one of the world's most important waterways, which has often shut down during the war with Iran, impacting energy supplies while putting ships and sailors in harm's way. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Good evening, Owen.
Veronica, good evening to you. Well, after meeting with the Vice President of Paraguay, U.S. President Donald Trump's Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke with reporters about the status of the Strait of Hormuz, which could be key to winding down the war with Iran.
Suffice it to say there's been progress made in those talks, but not finality yet. We're hoping that will happen very shortly.
Secretary Marco Rubio said ships continue to transit the Strait of Hormuz, but the U.S. would like to see more commercial traffic.
There's oil moving right now through the straits, so the straits are open. Nonetheless, I think that there's a conversation and negotiation that we are involved in between Oman and Iran on how more ships can be able to go through there safely in the short term.
The proposed deal between Iran and Oman would reportedly allow ships to enter the Persian Gulf on Iran's side and exit along Oman's side if the ships pay security fees, something the U.S. previously rejected. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told CNBC there is a chance we may have a deal today or tomorrow to open the strait and move towards a more normalized position in this conflict, and it would be freedom of movement. Qatar said it was helping mediate peace talks between the United States and Iran, despite conflicting claims from the two sides.
We are looking towards diplomatic resolution as we are speaking right now.
Qatar says it wants to find a short-term resolution that would help reignite the talks.
Our focus right now is on avoiding escalation, reopening the strait, and reopening the door for diplomacy.
Early today, a cargo ship reported being hit by an unknown projectile in the strait. That's according to the United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center. President Donald Trump, speaking from the Oval Office Monday, told reporters there are two phases.
But the first phase is the opening of the straits. The second phase will be the denuclearization, and that'll take a little while. But we're very strong on it. They cannot have a nuclear weapon. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon, and I have never changed.
And today, Secretary Rubio emphasized the president's demands regarding nukes.
They can never have a nuclear weapon. The president's been clear about that. So the denuclearization of Iran is the ultimate deal.
President Donald Trump now travels to the western United States, California and Nevada specifically, talk about the economy and support Republicans ahead of the midterms. Meanwhile, California Governor Gavin Newsom posted today, if we don't win in November, democracy in America is over. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Negotiators from Lebanon and Israel are meeting in Rome for a seventh round of talks as they work to implement a ceasefire framework agreed upon in June. The plan starts in phased pilot zones where Israeli forces will pull back from occupied southern Lebanon, allowing the Lebanese military to move in and disarm the Iranian-backed militia Hezbollah. The conflict erupted after U.S. and Israeli joint strikes on the Islamic Republic in February triggered Hezbollah rocket fire and a full scale Israeli invasion. However, major hurdles remain as Hezbollah opposes the direct talks and refuses to honor any agreement reached. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted to advance the nomination of Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche to lead the Department of Justice permanently. The party-line vote marks a massive victory for the White House after weeks of razor-thin margins, grueling hearings, and deep skepticism from both sides of the aisle. Let's check in with Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales, who attended the hearing. Eric.
Well, good evening, Veronica. Yeah, not a lot of fireworks today. It was pretty much just a formality, but it all came down to a dramatic 11th-hour concession by Todd Blanche late Sunday night. As we reported, for weeks, his path was completely blocked by two key Republican holdouts, Senator John Cornyn and Tom Tillis. They refused to vote for him without written assurances that the highly controversial $1.8 billion IRS anti-weaponization fund was officially dead. Now, prior to the vote, both Cornyn and Tillis spoke and were the only Republicans to give statements.
My vote to advance Mr. Blanche's nomination goes beyond this document. We need a stabilizing force at the Department of Justice, and Mr. Blanche deserves the opportunity to provide that.
Senator Tom Tillis focused on how both sides are to blame for weaponizing the DOJ.
The bottom line is nobody is clean here. And until we start recognizing this behavior as bad, we're just going to one-up it. Maybe it's a little bit more intense in this administration than the last one, and that a little bit more intense than the prior administration, and so on and so forth. But, folks, we've got to end this.
But committee Democrats put on a fierce fight and used today's hearing to target Blanche's history as President Trump's former defense lawyer, questioning his ability to remain independent. Democrats also grilled him over the Justice Department's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files, where sensitive personal data of survivors was accidentally leaked without redactions, a process Blanche was in charge of.
Todd Blanche participated in the cover-up, continues to participate in the cover-up, and is responsible for a massive screw-up of the release of the documents.
Others criticized him on the Trump's IRS concession, calling it a sham that leaves Trump's personal tax protections untouched, and his commitment to allow abortions also came up.
He would work to restrict abortion in every single state. That's not enforcing the law. That is a zealot, a warrior seeking to advocate the president's position against reproductive rights.
So what is next? Now that Blanche's nomination has passed the Judiciary Committee, it will be now up to the full Senate to confirm him. That vote will likely take place later this week or early next week. Veronica?
Eric, voters are heading to the polls across five states today as surging Democratic Socialist Movement tests its political muscle. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, a number of high-stakes races are taking place today. Let's go to the map and show our viewers where they are taking place. Voters are actually casting their votes out in Kansas, Virginia, Washington, Michigan, and Missouri. And all eyes, of course, will be in Michigan's Senate race. That's where Democratic Socialists and far-left candidate are running, like Abdul El Sayed. He is neck and neck with the Congresswoman Haley Stevens, a moderate Democrat. El Sayed notes that he is not a formal member of the Democratic Socialists of America, but has fully embraced their platform and even securing a high-profile backing from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and even Senator Bernie Sanders. And I'm also going to be watching the results of the statewide measure out in Kansas. That could replace the state's 68-year-old system of appointing justices with direct elections, a change that could reshape the future rulings of not only voter rights, but even abortions. I'll have more coming up tomorrow on EWTN News Nightly. Veronica, that's the latest. Back to you.
Thanks, Eric. Michigan health officials have confirmed the nation's first two deaths linked to an ongoing cyclospora outbreak. Both individuals had underlying health conditions complicated by the intestinal parasite, which causes severe diarrhea and dehydration. Nationwide cases have now topped 20,000, with federal officials tracing one major source to imported lettuce served at select Taco Bell locations. While cyclospora is easily treated in healthy outpatients, outpatients. Doctors warn severe dehydration poses serious risks to vulnerable individuals. A Spokane man is behind bars tonight, accused of setting the largest of three devastating wildfires burning through Washington State's second largest city. Police arrested 37-year-old Aaron Farinici on first-degree arson charges after a tip led detectives to the location of where the Old Trails fire began. The blazes have torched over 12 square miles, destroyed at least 700 structures, and forced 67,000 residents to evacuate. The Old Trails fire ignited Saturday northwest of downtown Spokane before jumping the river and sweeping through nearby neighborhoods. As firefighters battled the blazes over the weekend, returning residents were met with widespread devastation, finding their homes leveled to charred debris and, in many cases, leaving nothing standing except for isolated brick chimneys. According to the latest numbers from authorities, a Ukrainian drone strike on the Russian Black Sea beach has left 7 people dead, including 3 children, and injured 58 others. Local officials report that 21 victims remain hospitalized in regional centers, while dozens received outpatient care. In response, memorials honoring the victims have begun appearing across Russia. Moscow condemned the strikes as a targeted attack on civilians, characterizing the action as a war crime, and responded by launching a heavy barrage of aerial strikes across Ukraine. Desperate families in Morocco are searching for loved ones days after tens of thousands of migrants illegally crossed into Spain's North African enclave of Ceuta. Spanish authorities report at least 72 people died from drowning and stampedes during the chaotic crossing, while many others remain missing. The crisis has triggered a sharp international response, with France and Italy tightening border controls and U.S. officials criticizing Spanish migration policies following the deadly ordeal. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. Controversy sparks debate. Sophie Cunningham's opposition to biological male athletes in women's sports triggers a heated national debate and growing cultural rifts across the WNBA. We discuss the latest. Plus, FIFA clash. Gianni Infantino faces intense global backlash as leadership choices ignite fierce arguments across the world of soccer. A major cultural rift has erupted within the WNBA following comments by Indiana Fever guard Sophie Cunningham opposing the inclusion of biological male athletes who identify as, quote, transgender in women's sports. In an interview with ESPN, Cunningham said, "I want to protect young girls in a locker room or young girls in sport who shouldn't have to go against biological men." Cunningham defended her stance as common sense, adding, "There are rights that need to be protected." The issue has polarized fans and figures across the league, sparking both protests and counter rallies outside games. The situation has even sparked intense national debate over inclusion, fairness, and the core identity of women's sports. Joining me now is Caitlin Wheeler, a member of the Independent Council on Women's Sports, a former SEC champion swimmer, and a plaintiff in the landmark Gaines versus the NCAA lawsuit challenging policies that allow biological male athletes to compete in women's sports. Caitlin, such a pleasure for you to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Veronica. It's great to be here.
In your opinion, why has Sophie Cunningham's comments generated such a strong reaction?
Well, Veronica, the thing that stands out to me, I think, the most about Sophie is that she didn't have to do this. And I think that's what people need to understand here is Sophie is already successful. She's already an incredible athlete with a great platform. She could have easily stayed silent or quiet on this issue like so many other female athletes have. And honestly, I think that would have probably been the safer decision in this case. But we've seen what happens when women stand up and speak up about this issue. There's often a lot of criticism and immediate consequences that follow, people questioning their character. But Sophie chose to speak up anyways. And to me, that's what courage and bravery looks like. Courage isn't saying something when everyone agrees with you. That's the easy thing to do. Courage is saying it and doing the right thing. even when it may cost you something. And I think that's why so many young women and women, older women, myself, respect her and look up to her, is because she isn't doing this because she wants attention. She's doing this because she believes that women's sports and those little girls on the court out there who look up to her and have goals like she did, I'm sure, at one point. She knows that those girls are worth fighting for and that women's sports is worth protecting.
Now, this all set off because of the recently signed collective bargaining agreement between the WNBA and the Women's National Basketball Players Association. It says only players who are women are eligible to play in the WNBA, but the CBA doesn't actually define a woman. So there's been a lot of pushback. This is something you experience in your own sport. Can you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on this and where it goes from here?
Absolutely. You know, this is the part that is hard for me to understand. Is the WNBA that exists because women have their own category. You know, it's not controversial. It's the reason that the league exists is, you know, women have professional sports because we know that women deserve opportunities to compete against other women. Keyword women. The fact that they can't even define the word is silly to me. All you have to do is open a science book or a biology book and you'll understand. But the question becomes, how can an organization that was created to celebrate women, to platform women, is hesitant to defend the very thing that makes women's sports possible? How can the women who benefited from these opportunities not want to protect those same opportunities for the next generation? So it's baffling to me to understand that this organization refuses to take the right and, you know, most logical common sense stance. But I think their viewers are beginning to see through all of it and realize that, you know, Sophie Cunningham is doing the right thing here. And I'm hoping that many more female athletes will do the same.
Before we let you go, you're also a plaintiff in Gaines versus the NCAA. Can you give us a brief update on where that case stands and why you believe it remains an important legal battle?
Absolutely. We have an active case that's suing the NCAA for violating Title IX, which we know to be the statute that protects sex-based opportunities for athletes and many other areas, but specifically in sports, keeping men out of them. So this lawsuit is huge. It's going to be the next step in what determines college athletics, where we go from here as women's sports. But across the board, I think even in high school and middle school, all the age ranges, I think will set the precedent for the future of women's sports for sure.
Caitlin Wheeler, thanks for having the courage to speak up on this important topic, and thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
FIFA President Gianni Infantino is facing major international backlash after abandoning a controversial $20 billion private equity proposal to sell stakes in future World Cup profits. Top FIFA executives are publicly distancing themselves from the plan, which triggered fierce global outrage and threats of a complete boycott from European governing body, UEFA. The fallout has left Infantino's leadership severely shaken. Now, European officials are actively searching for a challenger ahead of next year's presidential election. Joining me now is Jonathan Wilson, football writer for The Guardian and author of the weekly Inside Football column. Thanks so much for coming on.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
For viewers who haven't been following this story, what's behind the conflict between FIFA and UEFA?
I mean, this is huge. There's been essentially a cold war between the two bodies, the global governing body and the European governing body, which has really been going on for getting on for a decade. And that's to do with money and politics and power, you know, the usual issues. But it's been brought to a head by what happened last Tuesday, which was Gianni Infantino, the head of FIFA, the global body, announcing a plan to sell off 21% of the World Cup to private investment, with $20 million initially to go to each of FIFA's constituent members. That then increased to $40 million if they agree within a seven-week period. UEFA has kicked back against that, and on Thursday, all 55 UEFA members said that they would boycott all FIFA competitions until this plan is taken off the table, which is a robustness of response and a solidarity of response that is very unusual in football.
Has this ever been done before, and what did he hope FIFA would gain from the deal? Potentially, even could he have gained personally from it?
Well, that's the huge question. So there was a sort of dry run at this in 2018. It wasn't quite as dramatic as this. And that also was headed off by UEFA threatening a boycott. I think the real question to ask is, why was this brought in the way it was? So Carlos Cordero, he was a former vice president of Goldman Sachs, a very senior, very well-respected banker. He was FIFA's chief financial advisor, and he was completely in the dark. So he's resigned over this. Now, if you're presenting a plan that you think is for the good of the game, is for the good of FIFA, why would you not run it by your chief financial advisor, somebody as respected as Carlos Cordero? Why did none of your top brass within FIFA, who all now said we had no idea, why would you not run it by them? So the secrecy, I think, adds to a sense of suspicion. But you also, we've just had a World Cup that brought in a record $15 billion. That's more than double the previous record, which was the last World Cup. So FIFA's in a very healthy place financially. Why do you need to sell off 21% of future revenues? And what comes out from FIFA, what comes out from Infantino is, oh, it's a great way to redistribute the wealth, to give the smaller, the poorer federations cash, and they can use it to build a new stadium or improve the training of referees, you know, all kinds of infrastructure projects. Well, FIFA's got the money. It's got $15 billion. I mean, okay, mm-hmm. There'll be some tax on that. So it's probably got an $8 billion spare. If you're giving out $40 million, you can give out $40 million to all 211 members anyway. You don't need this investment. So this is selling off future revenues for, as Cordero said, a pretty small bump now. And the only assumption can be that money is to be distributed among the heads of FIFA, the heads of the federations. And yeah, they can do that what they will. Maybe it's going into stadium projects, but a lot of the member associations of FIFA, I think it's fair to say their auditing processes are not that robust, and therefore the suspicion is of corruption.
As you know, it is a lucrative industry. In your opinion, can Gianni Infantino survive the backlash?
He's very damaged by this. So since he first came to power in 2016, he's been re-elected twice by acclamation. The assumption had been he'd be re-elected by acclamation again next year. Now, that's clearly not going to happen. He is going to be challenged. UEFA are saying that they will continue, I mean, their phrase, to paralyze FIFA until he resigns. And if that happens, I don't see how he survives at all. Otherwise, we've got horse trading with Infantino is talking about bringing forward the expansion of the World Cup from 48 teams. Like it was 32 until this tournament, so 48 itself was quite a big expansion. He's talking about expanding it again to 64. Now, that may bolster his support base in Africa, in Asia, and particularly in South America. But I think realistically, he's dead in the water, and it's just negotiating his exit now and working out the timing and who the fresh candidate could be.
Jonathan Wilson, thanks so much for coming on today and breaking it all down for us.
No worries. Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a simple saint who the church celebrates today and why his life has influenced generations. Today, August 4th, the church celebrates a much-loved saint whose piety and simplicity of life has inspired generations. Saint John Vianney was born to a family of farmers in France in 1786. While he struggled with his studies in the seminary, he was exemplary in his practice of virtue. After being ordained as a parish priest, he quickly was renowned for his spiritual direction. Towards the end of his life, he spent 16 to 18 hours a day in the confessional. He died in 1859. Was canonized in 1925 and is now the patron saint of parish priests. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.